On the Word again this Sunday in our homes, and we're going to jump right back into our series on apprenticing with Jesus, looking at the question, what does it mean when Jesus invites us and says to the church, follow me here in Canada, here in British Columbia, here in Clayton Heights? And I want to just comment on a statement Pastor Sid made last week. Actually, someone texted this statement last week to me. He said a lot of important things, especially about the role of being a pastor, but this is one of the things he said that stands out. I want to share it again. He said, without the gospel story, I am just a slave. I want to, in my preaching, tell the story of how Jesus liberated me from that slavery. That's a powerful statement about conversion, a powerful statement about apprenticing with Jesus. And as Sid mentioned, apprenticing with Jesus is being liberated by Jesus. It is Jesus, by his grace and his power, pulling us out of the power of sin under its weight, pulling us out from the idols we serve, pulling us out from the false, idolatrous stories that we live in. And this morning, we're going to hone in on the way in which apprenticing with Jesus is resisting cultural patterns. It's being pulled into a better story with a better Savior. So for that, I do invite you to turn to the passage Sonia already mentioned. That's Romans 12, 1 and 2. And for anyone who likes memorizing scripture, this is one of those passages that I encourage you to memorize. This is God's word for the church this morning. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is true worship. Do not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. I mentioned to Val this week that I see four sermons in this passage, and I only get to preach one of them this morning. A number of years ago, I had the chance to go to India with a friend of mine. Remember those days when we could get on planes and fly places? And it was one of those special trips where I was able to spend a whole week in a completely different culture. In fact, I've never been anywhere where I felt further away from Canada, not just in terms of geography, but also in terms of culture. The streets, the city, the architecture, the dress, the food, the temples that lined the streets where I was, it was so different than Canadian culture here. But the highlight for both of us who went was spending time with a group of university and graduate students who became Christians, many of whom not that long ago. And we got to hear the stories for several days. What made them become believers? And most of them, the vast majority of them, grew up in Hindu families, in a Hindu context, culture. And we got to hear how they heard Christ speak and how they came to faith in this person named Jesus. But equally impacting to me was hearing them struggle with how then to live in their families, Hindu families, in their academic institutions, with their friendships. There seemed to be no part of their life where they weren't struggling with, okay, now I'm a disciple of Jesus, living in this network of relationships, in this culture that's very Hindu. How do I practice my faith here? What does it mean for me as a student? What does it mean for me as a friend? What does it mean for me and my family? And there's a sense in which they felt more and more that there's this mold they grew up in, the Hindu mold, this culture around them. And now they had broken out of that by Jesus, and they were struggling with how to live in that culture as apprentices of Jesus. Flying back to Canada, I could not help but feel, especially as I was discipling a number of international students, do we have the same kind of struggle? As we come to faith here in Canada, as we grow in faith here in Canada, do we have that same sense of struggle about how we've been broken free from the cultural mold and live distinctively as apprentices of Jesus in a different story? It seems to me one of the challenges that we face, and I hear this from people who come to Canada, is the myth, and I have to say this as often as I can, the myth that Canada is a Christian culture, that somehow it's favorable or neutral even towards a Christian faith when it is most evidently not. And I think many people, when they think about conversion to Christianity, it's almost an image. This is a strong image, but it's how I feel sometimes. We see ourselves sort of building our identity, and we've got a shopping cart, we're going down the aisle of life, and we're picking all these things that we want to make part of our identity. So if you're an Apple or Android person, you pick Apple or For Android, you put that in your cart. That's part of your identity. You're a Chiefs fan or a Buccaneers fan. You put one of those teams in your cart. That's part of your identity. And then you sort of have to think, okay, well, what faith is going to be part of my identity? And you pick Christianity. And it's one of those elements you add to your life that you build into your own identity. Or it becomes another subtitle on your Twitter handle, sort of Jesus follower with the praying hands. But do we see it as a completely different way of inhabiting this world? A lens through which you see every dimension of your human life differently. Is it something, your Christian faith, that re-narrates the whole of your life? Because that's what apprenticeship is. And that's what these Indian students were struggling with as they came to faith, recognizing that there's a mold that the culture was pressing them into, and they no longer fit that mold because of Christ. Do we see the Canadian mold, the Canadian story, the secular faith of the society that we grow up in? Do we see how institutions, schools, friendships, all of societal life, social media, forms us in a certain way? We see the world a certain way. We imagine what it means to be human a certain way. That's different from other places and other cultures. In fact, if you ever have hosted someone in your home or spent time with someone from a very different culture, they will notice just how Western you are. Do you realize that when you drive to work in the morning, you're being discipled in all sorts of ways? Just this week, I was driving up Fraser Highway, and I was beside a bus near Willowbrook Mall, and I saw on the side of that bus, "Born to Shop." We're being discipled. Do you realize that when you open Twitter or Instagram or Facebook and you're scrolling through, you're being discipled? Your heart is trying to be grabbed by all sorts of voices, shaping you into a certain person, often a consumer at their will. Do you see how when you turn on the television later this afternoon for football, the worst sport, that you're going to be discipled in a variety of ways? Maybe not the worst sport. There are worse sports. I want to share with you just briefly an experience I had a number of years ago. I'm not a football fan, as you already know, and I was in somewhere in the States, on the West Coast. We were in San Diego, and we were at this giant football stadium, two teams, and we were sitting in a section of people where there are a lot of university students. And by the way, at football games, as you fans will know, there's like rituals. There's like a liturgy with football. And at the beginning of the game, I was just fascinated by all that was happening. They had the marching band on the field. They had like soldiers on the field. They had everyone stand up and sing the anthem. And as they sung the anthem, they stretched out like a zillion foot size American flag over the field. All the people singing. And then they had like an F-18 flying over. And I was looking around like, this is crazy. Like, this is discipleship. This is identity formation about who you are as a person. What does it mean to be at this game? Who you are as an American? And we have the same things here in Canada. Maybe just not as extreme with our football. Do you see how you are being discipled? You are being formed into a cultural pattern to see the world, inhabit the world, and live in a certain vision of what it means to be human. To a tiny little church, and I do mean a tiny little church, living in Rome, Paul writes these incredibly powerful words. He says, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, I urge you, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is true worship. Do not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, his pleasing, and his perfect will." Now, this passage has a movement to it. It starts with, in view of God's mercy, the gospel of grace, offering your whole life as an act of worship. And in order for that to happen, you have to, one, resist the patterns of culture, the idolatrous ways that you're formed in ways that are not of Christ, and then learn and be transformed by the renewing of your mind, which then results in discerning and living in God's good, pleasing, and perfect will. But it begins with an invitation to give the whole of our lives to Jesus as an act of worship. And this by itself is a radical statement in the West. I still think, when I look around, that we as Christians often divide up our lives in strange ways that we do not see in this passage. Sort of the secular life over here, the spiritual life over there. The spiritual life has Sunday morning, it has some prayer time, maybe youth group on Monday or Tuesday. The secular life has school, your work, your time in the neighborhood, your vacation life. God manages this, I manage that. You live in this bifurcated life where you don't see every dimension, every portion of time, every hour of the day, wherever you find yourself, as an act of worship. Do we see the whole of our lives as worship? That the lives we live in these bodies as an act of worship. Apprenticing with Jesus is holding out before our Father the entirety of life. Your marriage, your leisure, your time behind the screen, your time with friends, your hours at work. That is an act of worship. And I want to read for you a quote that comes from William Barclay. You'll notice just by how he speaks, it's a few years old, but I love this quote. He says, in a summary of Paul's statement, I think I have it on the screen for you. Paul's saying here, take your body, take all of the tasks that you have to do every day. Take the ordinary work of the shop, the office, the factory, the shipyard, the mine, and offer all of that as an act of worship to God. We might say, I'm going to church to worship God, but we should also say, I'm going to the factory, the shop, the office, the school, the garage, the mine, the shipyard, the field, the cowshed, the garden, the laptop, I would add, to worship God. Do you see apprenticeship that way? Do you see the faith that we have in Jesus as pulling us into this kind of life? And for this to happen, this is a critical point. For this to happen, we need to realize that every way we live in every part of society is shaped by some story. The way you do your work, the way you live with your friends, the way you do your travel and leisure, the way you do every piece of your life is shaped by some story. And I could give tons of examples of how work is not shaped for many of us by the biblical story. And Jesus, when he says, "Follow me," invites us to break the cultural way that we see how these things are done and inhabit these spaces, these activities, as apprentices, following Jesus, serving God, seeking first the kingdom. Now, the church in Rome, to whom this letter was written, they had a very similar experience of being a small community in a big culture that lived out of a different story. And I want you to imagine them for a minute. Again, they're a little community, a brand new community, in this big Roman Empire. This empire was the most impressive of empires. It had a very significant place in Western history. And there's a story that came with the Roman Empire. People who grew up in this city, they were forged in a certain way, the same way that Canadians are forged in a certain way in our cities. They had a certain vision for what a city was about, a certain vision for why they worked, a certain understanding of their place in society and what life was all about. And everything, and I do mean this, everything in Roman society tailored towards this vision of Rome. The games, the feasts, the architecture, all of it was shaping. They had statues all over the city telling the story of all their military victories, how it was so great to be in this city of Rome, how Caesar should be worshipped, and he was worshipped because he was a god. This was all telling a story of what it means to be human, what it means to live and enjoy the world as a good Roman citizen. And in the midst of this big Roman story, there's this church. And these Christians happen to have heard, probably through evangelism, through a variety of things, the message of a different king, a rabbi who walked around talking about the arrival of a different kingdom, who spoke about a different story, about God working in a different kind of way than Romans would even understand the gods. They saw this and heard about this rabbi who could heal and speak with authority, teach with a different ethic on loving friends, loving enemies, loving neighbors. And as they heard this message, they were wooed by the power and authority with which it came. And much to everyone's surprise, this little group of people who at some point became called Christians, followers of the way of Jesus, broke free from that Roman mold. They saw this big, powerful, pervasive Roman story as a false story. More than that, they saw it as an enslaving story. And Jesus broke into these people's lives, liberating them from all of its sin and bringing them into freedom. I want to pause and emphasize that for all the Christians then, and Christians in every generation, in every city throughout the world, that process of breaking free from the idolatrous story, the lies of culture, the power of sin, and being liberated into the family of Jesus is a slow, often painful process of seeing how you've been formed in all sorts of conscious and unconscious ways to think like your culture thinks, to practice and have habits like your culture has, and be formed in ways that you now are trying to shift. And together, and we're going to talk about this in the next couple weeks, how as a community practice ways that steep and nurture one's heart and one's life in the way of the kingdom. And this little Roman church, they had to unlearn bad habits of worshiping a human, worshiping this Caesar who would be killed, and that's the end of it. And they started learning how to feast in ways that honored God. In fact, they had to not participate in many practices of culture because they were so violent, so explicit, and had to learn new practices like communion, where they gathered around a table to celebrate King Jesus and all that he had done and accomplished. This slow process of unlearning old habits, being liberated into this new family that was actually flourishing as the way God intended from the beginning. And as it happened, they stood out. As they followed the way of Christ, as they apprenticed with him and they learned to be like him, do what he did, they stood out from the Roman story. They didn't beat to the tune of the Roman world. They didn't live the way Romans lived. And people just could not figure out these Christians. In fact, there's a lot of writing where writers and authors of the time are trying to figure out why they live the way they live. I want to read for you a quote. This comes from what's called the Epistle of Diognetus. And we don't know who wrote it. But it was written in all likelihood to a man named Diognetus who is suspicious or at the very best exploring and trying to make sense of the Christians. And I want to suggest to you before I read it that line by line, whoever wrote this is doing incredible cultural contrast to the Roman story and how the Christians are living. And I hope that as you hear it, you'll see how it just speaks on so many levels to the church today. This is what the Epistle to Diognetus says. They, the Christians, they dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others, and yet they endure all things as if foreigners. They marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. What a word in season. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, and at the same time surpass the laws in their lives. They love all and are persecuted by all. They are poor, yet they are make many rich. They are completely destitute, and yet they enjoy complete abundance. They are reviled, and yet they bless. When they do good, they are punished as evildoers, undergoing punishment. They rejoice because they're brought back to life. Isn't that a powerful quote? What a statement to describe the church. Hey, Diognetus, you want to make sense of the church? This is how they live. And if I had more time, I'd show you line by line how all the ways they lived were just running against the grain of Roman culture, running against the grain of how people assumed you should live the good Roman life. And here's my question. You ready for it? Could the same kind of letter be written to a Diognetus of our day? The one who's trying to make sense of the Christians in West Coast British Columbia, what would be said to them? Could we say things like what they're saying? They live simply, like sojourners. They held their citizenship loosely because they were citizens of the kingdom. They live simply. Could we say that these were the kind of people who practiced a common table? They broke bread with strangers and enemies. They learned community that cut through social boundaries, but they did not share their beds. There was fidelity in the marriage covenant. Could we say these kinds of things of the church today? Have we stopped and thought about, at a deep level, what faithful non-conformity to our cultural patterns looks like for the church today? How might the gospel be calling us to break the molds that we are currently living in, even unconsciously, in our daily Canadian habits? And I'll just ask a few questions that I hope prompt for conversation around your lunchroom table this afternoon or dinner table. And I do invite you to have further conversation as families and couples and friends over what I'm about to ask. How might the gospel, just for starters, how might apprenticing with Jesus change the way you interact with social media? How might it change the way it shapes you? If it's true that most of us spend upwards of 20 hours on social media each week, how might an apprentice of Jesus use and sort of renew the way these mediums and medias are used? What's it look like for you? Is it a habit that's forging you in a certain way? And how then, as an apprentice, do you faithfully engage with these media? Or how might, as an apprentice of Jesus, you live in the academic world? I am so convinced that the academic world is such a powerful apprenticing community. And as students go to school and university, how are we resisting the message of making your job, first of all, about just what you want to do, how you can get a lot of money and live a comfortable life? How do we make our academic life about growing our gifts, serving the community, and not first and foremost being preoccupied with money? How are you apprenticing with Jesus and resisting the cultural mold in the academic world? Or your work life? Let's talk about that. I'm convinced that most of us, when we walk into workplaces, we're walking into a culture that's going to form us in a certain way. And I don't know everyone's workplace, but I know enough of our workplaces to know that there's sort of the corporate ladder, there's the way in which you got to navigate the politics so you can be on top. How might you, as an apprentice, break that mold and be someone who seeks to serve the kingdom of God and bless and love one's neighbor through that vocation? How do we apprentice in our workplaces? Or how might we apprentice with Jesus in our singleness, in our marriage? I'm struck by some of the comments that are made in this epistle to Diognetus and how prophetic they speak now to the church today, where now if you want to live any way you want in your sexual life, that's for you to decide. There is no authority above you. You are the center in our culture. How might the apprentice of Jesus, who gives us the way of life, live singly, live in a marriage relationship, and honor God's creational design for these institutions and relationships? James K. Smith, who wrote a book called You Are What You Love, which is a summary of a more complicated book, he says that families should be having audits of their family life, where you sort of walk through your weekly habits, your monthly habits, and just ask the question, how am I being formed by these habits? Like, what is my 30 hours of Netflix doing to my soul? How is it shaping my desires? What vision of the human life is it giving me? And someone just recently, by the way, described to me how Netflix for them is a Trojan horse. It's always a story that you like, and then at some point it becomes this cultural hijacking saying, hey, here's the priorities we want you to have as an individual Western in person. Here's what really matters to us. How do we apprentice with Jesus in those places with these habits? And what might faithful nonconformity look like? I'm convinced we need to have more conversations, not just as families, not just as couples, but as a church, saying, what does it look like for us to live and practice new things, new ways, as followers of Jesus? Now, to return to where I began, Pastor Sid made that audacious comment that he, without the gospel story, would be a slave. And I want to say differently now, whenever Jesus calls us into nonconformity with idolatrous cultural patterns, he is inviting us to life. There is this, I think, very false narrative that to become a Christian is to say no to all the good things in life. You sort of stay home while everyone's having the party. And that is the opposite of what's happening when Jesus invites us to follow him. What's really happening is the Lord of life is saying, you will be destroyed by the idols of this culture in one way or another. You'll be enslaved in ways you won't even be able to see, and I'm inviting you to the life to the full. And what's really happening in our culture is false offers of salvation. A false story, even every commercial I watch, I'm so surprised at how often there's this implicit, sometimes just straight up explicit, offer of the good life through this purchase, this lifestyle, this thing, this relationship. I want to read a quote for you that we're reading in Surge. This comes from a book called The Symphony of Mission by Mike Goheen and Jim Mullins. And Jim Mullins wrote this part, and I just find this to sing very powerfully. He writes, "Culturally, we've sought salvation in technologies that have certainly benefited the world, but have never fulfilled their promises. Often they've simply made new and bigger problems. Nuclear fission brings heat to cold homes, but also the threat of a nuclear winter. The internet promises to bring us together, but it makes the world a lonely people who spend more time looking at glowing rectangles than in the faces of other people. In an attempt to solve the mystery of the world's brokenness, we've also established political and economic systems like communism, socialism, and capitalism, along with many other failed isms that promise freedom, but leave us as slaves. Even modern-day health fads, you ready for this, Hope? Even modern-day health fads are an attempt to solve the mystery of brokenness, but essential oils aren't potent enough to cover the stench of sin. Veganism will never find enough kale to cover our shame. Sorry to the kale lovers. A paleo diet cannot restore us to the original human condition. CrossFit cannot make us strong enough to carry the weight of the world's brokenness. Our world is marked by a brutal and comprehensive brokenness. We are spiritually cut off from God, socially separated from one another, physically alienated from the flourishing we were intended to experience from the beginning. That's the issue. And what culture is doing in so many deceptive, false ways, saying, here's where you find salvation, this purchase, this relationship, this social media, this number of followers, this self-determined identity. And Jesus, when he invites us to follow him as an apprentice, he's saying, that is slavery. Let me show you the real problem, and let me liberate you in the deepest possible way. The problem is sin. And I want to return at the end of my sermon to where Paul begins in this passage. How does Paul start? It says, therefore, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, all the commands, all the urging Paul makes about breaking the cultural mold, about being transformed by the renewing of our minds, it all hinges on what in the world he means when he says, in view of God's mercy. N.T. Wright, in his commentary on this passage, he says, Christian living never begins with a set of rules, though it contains them as it goes forward. It begins with glad self-offering of one's whole self to God, whose mercy has come all the way to meet us in our rebellion, in our sin, and death. While we were still sinners, God, in his mercy, through the work of Jesus Christ, liberated us from the power of sin and death and Satan. Two or three weeks ago, Brittany and I sat down and we watched The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a good movie. Not as good as the book, but still a good movie. And I have a favorite scene, and I've seen this movie twice now, and both times it's the one that kind of gets the hair on my arms kind of lifting up. And it's right after Aslan, he's put on the stone tablet, he's killed by the queen, and the stone tablet breaks, and Aslan is now resurrected, and he's running, but he doesn't run to the battle. If you know the story, there's a battle happening, and it's not looking good for humanity. But Aslan runs to a different place. He runs to the castle where the queen is, and he runs into the area where there's hundreds of frozen animals under the spell of that queen. And what he does is breathe on these animals. And this ice melts away, and they slowly come alive, and they see him. And the beautiful thing in that scene is they look in the face of the person, the animal, who has already defeated the queen. And in the same way, as Christ, by his power, breathes life into us by the Spirit, as we follow him, we're following the one who's already defeated the power of sin. He has already defeated Satan by the cross. He's already risen victoriously over the grave. And we stand in his power, by his authority, by his Spirit, as free people who stand behind the one who's already won the victory. And the goal of our life is to live in the freedom he's already provided us by way of his death and his resurrection. When Jesus invites us to follow him, he invites us into liberation from the power of sin, the idols of culture, and the false stories. Do you know what you've been invited into? And do you know what you are being pulled out of? You know, one of my prayers for our church is that we get to encounter the Diognetes of today, that there are serious people asking really good questions about what the church is for, why the church exists, why they don't seem to fit the mold of Canadian society. I hope that our church has many opportunities where people say, you just don't fit in here. What's the deal with you? And you have the chance to say, let me tell you about the one who has liberated us from the power of sin and the freedom I found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.